Hi, everybody, and thanks for coming. My name is Brad Stone. I'm a technology writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, and we are very fortunate today to have one of the most interesting and entertaining venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, Bing Gordon. So I figured that most of you know that Bing is a board member of Zynga and a longtime board member of Amazon, that he works for Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. But I've prepared some perhaps lesser known facts about Bing. His first name is William. In his 20s, he was a theater actor and commercial fisherman. His brother is married to his wife's sister. I'll get a response from him on one of these. He's an avid Farmville and a Cityville player, and he's achieved top status in both. And I just saw him play Scramble with Friends, and he's a maestro. He's traveled frequently to Africa and learned tribal dance. And is it true an African chieftain named his son Bing?
Yes. And the bad thing about having an African chieftain who names his son after you is you have to send a cow or a goat every year.
And Bing also has a sort of famous affinity for poetry. And so we thought that perhaps we would kick things off today with a poem that he's prepared for this occasion.
It's my job, someone has to do it. Austin City Limits. It's stressful to do a keynote. One feels so alone. Better just to get raked over the coals by Brad Stone. If he gets a journalistic scoop here, I will not be bitter. I am Big Fish. He is Brad Stone. Look him up on Twitter. Whether you came here to socialize or just be on vacation, I promise you, life is better when you buy into gamification. You can rock your company launch in this madness and dither. This week's kind of like Farmville. Plant your companies, just don't let them wither. Welcome to the Austin City Limits. The weather's perfect here, except when we're in it. People come for the music, the clubs, and good times, but we turn it into Occupy Austin because of all these effing long lines. Mm-hmm. Who needs local microbrews or border smuggled drugs? We get high on life here at South By as we squat on the rugs. In your everyday life, you might be famous or larger, but here you have to beg for party invites or to use someone's AC recharger. Put a drink in your fist. This is no place to be shy. There are 35,000 extroverts this week at South By. You can taste experimental music here or experiments in pork. I recommend the Big Ass Burger at this restaurant called Roaring Fork. This is the place to discover companies like Path, Zarly, or Splunk, and which of your colleagues gets lucky when drunk. Go see Third Eye Blind if you're in the in crowd, but please don't upload Steven Jenkins to SoundCloud. For gamers, Austin is way more than just Hook'em Horns. It's actually the city where massively multiplayer online games were born. I'd like to tip my hat to Richard and Robert Garriott, Lord British, the original campers who relocated Origin Systems and Ultima here from New Hampshire. It was the taxes. Get the best hotel room this week you can afford. If you have to do it on Airbnb and you have to entertain yourself with Flipboard, Austin's a city where Lance Armstrong, Whole Foods, and Dell are revered, and it's your job this week to live up to the city's slogan, which is Keep Austin Weird.
Thank you for that, Bing. So I consider the time that I spent playing Madden football in SimCity as to be almost kind of wasted time. A great chunk of my 20s were swallowed in those games. And yet you've said that playing games is almost key to being a good entrepreneur these days or to running a company. Explain that.
Well, first I have to say this is why we have different lines of work, because I consider the time I spent writing essays for college to be time wasted. I think that every Fortune 500 company should have a gamer on in the executive suite. I think game design is the new MBA. So if you don't have an MBA yet, play World of Warcraft instead. It's only $12 a month instead of $40,000 a year. and the people are nicer. And I do think that building an organization is like building and playing a game. So if you're building a company, you want to have a product that people over 35 don't understand, and you want to hire employees who are under 35. So people who are under 35 turned 16 with the launch of Netscape, so they've grown up always digital. A guy named Bob Pittman, who known as the founder of MTV, but before that he started the first experimental interactive TV thing called Cube in Ohio. He came to this realization that people in the West make, or in the US, make their lifelong media affinity choice at age 16. You remember when you get your driver's license? You kind of stop time and all you wanted to do was drive. So childhood is before you were 16. And so in 1995, the people who turned 16 then, born in 79, are now 32 or 33. So anybody that age or younger has a whole different outlook on life. And one is that the world looks like games. So if you are running a company or managing one of those people, you can't do what your college professors did to you, which is feedback in a week or two. You know, there's none of this talk it later. You can't do the let's have lunch and schedule it for 3 months later. People who game are instant feedback. So as a leader of that generation, you have to find a way to give instant feedback. I think that's why computers are so addicting, is because of the instant feedback.
What are some of the product elements that you think of when people talk about, you know, gamifying a product?
Well, actually, before talking about, I started calling it video gamification. I started even before that thinking video game design thinking. There's David Kelly, who founded IDEO in the Stanford D School, has this concept of design thinking, which is user-centered innovation, looking for latent needs, and then constant prototyping from low res to high res. So the first place, the most important thing to think about with gamification is that people like stuff that feels right. Do you think that's my phone?
It's not mine.
I thought I powered down. I did power down. I think that's the microphone. It's not a microphone in my pocket. That's a SoundCloud app running on iOS right now. So, you know, what seems right looks more like a game and less like a book. And what seems right is more like the party dynamics in World of Warcraft and less like a cube. So I think the first thing about gamification is to understand that people who grew up playing games look at the world differently. If any of you remember a Tetris TV commercial, which is I've been Tetrisized, and somebody walks around through daily life seeing the Austin city limits skyline, or seeing a basketball team looking like shapes in Tetris, we get to the point where games seem more normal than Gutenberg.
So do you think games changed your outlook, or did they really like mold our synapses, or do our brains, those of us in our 20s and 30s and early 40s?
Well, as you know, I am a practicing medical doctor and brain researcher.
Let's ignore it.
I think I was voted most least likely to succeed in college, but the video game business was designed by high potential kids who were bored in school. Don't feel bad about it. And the other one is 6 months after graduation, the A students are borrowing money from the C students. What was the question?
Yeah, I was asking about brain design.
There's research coming that the brain does change, especially from exposure to rich media. And I think we're going to seeing that the illusion that multitasking is more productive. We're going to see a generation that is more productive multitasking. It's just a learned skill.
So you're saying that basically entrepreneurs need to design with a new audience, a new generation, a different way of thinking. So what for product designers in the audience? What specifically? Give us two or three things to think about that you've seen work at, some of your companies like Zynga.
Well, let's see. I'd say the speed is one place to start. So starting with pace. So if you're going to build a company, you have to do it like World of Warcraft guild leaders build guilds. You have a weekly calendar and weekly check-ins. And you agree in advance on a process to split up the loot. And if you're Dave Morin running a company, you hope that your guild doesn't try to kill the boss. I think there's the other thing about gamers is they believe that constant improvement is possible. So if you're playing a Pogo game or you're playing WoW with experience going up, There are multiple ways to win, but every session you can get better. So you want to do this for your employees that on their own personal career arc that they can get feedback of constant improvement, both in the short term, medium, and long term. The next thing that you want to do is this is something that civilians don't understand. But the most powerful aspect of gaming is not competition, but cooperation. And so you need to build structures where cooperation is rewarded. In MMO, in RPG parties, okay, that's not me. I think it must be that. Well, I'll ignore it. It's that brain implant that is supposed to increase my memory. It turns out in a party of five, even if they're strangers in what's called a pickup group, you come to expect that each individual is about 20% more productive through overlapping skills. It's the math of teamwork in small teams in games. We kind of know in sports teams that you want a shortstop who can't hit unless you're A-Rod, and you want a first baseman who can't run, and you want a pitcher who can bunt. You want these various skills. That's what builds a winning team. But companies tended to think of individuals as more alike, maybe in different functions, but more alike. So architecting a company as you would architect the social practice in a game, so groups of five get clear feedback from improvement and productivity. And the goal is five people should be measurably 20% more productive kind of per hour, per week, if they team accordingly. And then privileges. Privileges are like levels in gaming, so the sense of like constant improvement, but milestones. I'm a believer in badges. For any of you who like getting a gold star on your forehead when you're in kindergarten for doing really good finger painting, you may remember that feeling. We found that this company Badgeville is kind of doing some leading this, but we found that once you get people starting to believe in virtual rewards, that it doubles behavior. So whatever behavior you were gonna get, so you have people who are already doing output, if you can create a system of virtual rewards, you can change behavior. Steve Jobs once told me, "Bing, you're so effing stupid, nobody gets motivated by fake stuff." And I said back, "Steve, do you know anybody who buys Nikes?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, that's a $7 shoe and a $143 fake thing of virtual good." So the power of virtual goods is just becoming understood. So I think more broadly, a way to think about games is they are a system for creating meaning. And hasn't led to any wars yet, like some of the other systems for creating meaning that involve deities. Maybe our time will come and we actually will create wars.
But what is it? What does all this mean for like the top guy, the CEO? What is you know, leading a company according to gamification principles? What does that look like?
Feedback, clear feedback, constant improvement, a scoring system, a win-win environment, and you know. A joy in raids, you know, and if you start thinking of crunch time as we're going after Anixia, you kind of need to do an out-of-body experience to get past the pain and suffering of crunch time and actually realize this is our best and highest use.
Ostensibly, you can't compensate employees with badges.
Why?
In lieu of actual money.
Oh, no, it's in addition.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, niceness, being nice to people doesn't cost money either, but it's kind of motivating. And it's really clear that optimism enhances creativity, and optimism doesn't necessarily cost money. So, you know, if you're creating a brand or you're creating a company, your job is to create meaning. Starting a company is god-awful scary. It's like every day you go to work looking into a black hole of the unknown, and you have to create a platform of confidence for your employees and for yourself and for your family. And games are one way to create meaning.
So you've said these principles are relevant not just to, you know, product designers and managers, but to everyone, students or musicians, writers. Explain how.
Well, let's see. In general, I think we're moving from an age of memorization or learning by listening, learning by reading, to an age of learning by doing. And gaming as an approach to life as a gaming is very much learning by doing. People who play games don't read manuals. If you tell me if you read a manual before you jump into a game, I know that you're over 40. And so it's this kind of jump in and find the edges. And that's how we all ought to work. Gamers know in virtual worlds that if you see a door, you'll always open it. And gamers know that the expert way to play is to lose as fast as you can to find the edges. Entrepreneurs kind of know that the secret is to lose fast and find edges. Most civilians don't know that. They kind of waste time by being afraid to fail fast. So games really reward failing fast. Now, if you fail fast playing Madden, you may get your best friend this far away from your face laughing at you. You may see an instant replay of a bad move. But the way you find money plays in Madden is by trying stuff that would otherwise seem crazy. And, you know, the way you start a company is by doing stuff that other people thought were crazy.
Yeah, but what if you're at an institution like a university that doesn't that punishes failure?
If you're a professor and you think that the future of education is being a talking head with a 10-year-old PowerPoint, you know, you're already a dinosaur. The future of education is John Dewey and John Madden. You know, it's not talking heads.
John Madden is the future of education. Somebody should tweet that. You have any good John Madden stories from your days at EA?
John Madden, you know, I think all invention has great stories. So, you know, there's a couple of John Madden stories. So, So I was the exec in charge of both marketing and product when we were building this game. And the first time we did John Madden, we got this Apple II 7-on-7 football game. And John Madden was 2 degrees removed from one of our board members, the famous.
This is at Electronic Arts.
This is at Electronic Arts in like 1984. And so we got this 7-on-7 Apple II game, and it was a marvel. You know, it was running at like almost 15 frames a second, and the whole thing fit in the 140K floppy disk and in the 48K of RAM. And it had a clay drawing thing, all with X's and O's, and we thought it was awesome, and we were amazed that it even ran. And so after we inked the deal with Coach Madden, who, you know, you always, with, I got a lot of Madden stories, but we came in for his rubber stamp because we're about to complete our first print ad to run in Soft Talk magazine back when an ad campaign for a game cost $40,000 a page. And he came in and he goes, "That's not football." We said, "Coach, this is on Apple II. We got 7 on 7. They're all moving. They all have artificial intelligence." And he goes, "That's not football. You notice there's only 7 guys on each team? That's not football. You can't ship that." And he left the room. So we shipped the game 3 years later. I think by then the Apple had 128K of RAM. But that was 3 years. So another Madden story, then we launched that, and then we decided to bring Madden Football on the Sega Genesis, which launched in the States. It was Mega Drive in Japan. And so I did research. You know, I'm less negative about research than Jobs famously was. I think you got to take it with a grain of salt. Sometimes it's good, and sometimes it makes for good stories. But the research came back, and it was something like 40% preferred Electronic Arts football, and 20% preferred touchdown football, and 10% of people who were playing sports games on Nintendo NES like John Madden football. And we were mystified, and we went and asked kids, and at the time it was 14-year-olds, and, you know, "How did you come out this way?" And they go, "Well, John Madden, he's that fat old guy who does hardware commercials." They didn't know he was involved in football. I decided, I don't care, we're going to make a better game if we make it on Madden, because the team believed in Madden. Madden had done a college curriculum. Madden had written a couple of books. The first one was 1 knee equals 2 feet. He had the concept of the All-Madden team. He had a well-described game planning, and we could extract the math from him because we thought of ourselves as trying to be ghost writers. So we needed a body of work. And so we launched the game as Madden Football. Then the next thing I found out, it's... there were 2 John Maddens. Madden, in one of his books, talks about when he was a fan of Vince Lombardi. Does everybody like football, or is this too much football talk? There's more Madden stories. He went to see Vince Lombardi talk about the Green Bay sweep, thinking it was going to be a 15-minute talk, and it lasted for 4 hours. And that's when Madden raised his aspiration level for what it took to be a coach. You know, again, you know, I see more in here, but when you hang out with Zuckerberg or with Jobs, it kind of raises your aspiration level. So, you know, Vince Lombardi at the time was, you know, kind of the Steve Jobs of the NFL.
Well, let's fast forward through your EA career a little bit.
And you better fast forward. You can find out, you know, one question can last a long time.
Well, let's talk about the day you met Mark Pincus. I recall hearing that you met him while you were at EA. So he came to present, I would imagine, his ideas for Zynga to Electronic Arts. Tell me about meeting him for the first time and you know, in that moment, and, you know, if and how it led you to ultimately leave EA and become a venture capitalist.
I realized in kind of as we were starting Electronic Arts that I think it's important in times of stress to know what your values are and know what makes you work. And I realized that what made me work on a daily basis was contributing to a world-class creative process, contributing to great people's development, and making money. And I'd kind of started to run out of people to develop, and I was kind of looking. A lot of the people I worked with now had homes and were presidents, and then there's another group starting out. And I met Pincus, and I kind of recognized somebody that would be cool to hang out with that I could give something to. But, you know, because it's a former company, I don't want to give too many salacious details. But he came in under duress and a bunch of saber rattling from a big company to a small company. And I stopped the meeting and said, "You guys, this person here has a vision of the future that we should pay attention to, and I think we ought to invest in them and get close." And Pincus said, Zynga can be your Walmart and connect you to an all new audience, which, you know, sounds like crazy talk. If you've read The Innovator's Dilemma, you know how hard it is to change fitness functions. So Pincus and I started going on bike rides. He didn't know anybody who had ever built a game. And I didn't know anybody other than a couple people I'd met at Facebook.
So at this point, had he done poker on Facebook?
He'd done poker and a couple of the little unsuccessful things. And at EA, I was ranting about the API-able internet as the future of gaming. But it was a rant. Visionaries who rant don't get a lot done. You always need a St. Paul to actually communicate to real people. And I was ranting, and we'd started some stuff, none of which was working. I think we started 4 Facebook apps at the same month that that Zynga Poker launched. And by the time I met him, they had all cratered, and poker was still growing. But it wasn't. It was like the 35th poker game on. It wasn't, by far and away, it was not the leading app. At the time, Scrabulous was taken off, Slide was taken off. I loved the way he held the room. You know, he said, I have this vision, and it combined things that I'd been wrestling with and kind of pushing around in my head. But at the time, I thought casual games, virtual goods, microtransactions, social networks. I thought they were all separate vectors. And he just stood up and kind of in 2 sentences put them all into one piece. So I love that when people can get in their head potentially conflicting ideas to make it into one.
So if you had to boil down to sort of one thing that made Zynga succeed, you know, in a remarkable way, while those other kind of Facebook app makers did not succeed as much, what would it be? What did Mark figure out?
It starts with Pincus. He has, Fred Wilson says about him, he's one of the successful people who stays hungry, and on a daily basis. Even we're all challenged with other interests and, you know, health and family and energy ups and downs, and he just brings it every day like few people I've seen. He also had this, he had the heart of a gamer. He's kind of the heart of an entertainer. I think to do consumer apps, you have to be somebody who can throw good parties, and he throws great parties. He handed out wigs at his wedding reception so everybody would get wild and loose, and he and his wife kind of led the snowball dance with what kind of almost like, I better not go there. But so he's got the spirit of an entertainer, and he thinks in quant. So, and he also thought this was his time in life. You know, I really like seeing people who just say, you know what, I'm going to take all my discipline and all my energy and get focused because this is going to work. And he even quotes Tony Robbins as saying, Most people find ways to forgive themselves for failure. He says, you just can't, you know, failure, it's your own fault. It's never somebody else's fault. He said that to Al Gore. And in front of a group like this, I think. So he just decided at this point in life he'd had success, but he wanted to create something bigger and more lasting himself. So I think that combination of his skills and this kind of will to put all of his life energy into a single thing. And then, you know, he had a loyal group of people he'd built companies with before. He had deep understanding of analytics at a time when most people were doing fake analytics. I think he's got... He and Reid Hoffman at the time are the people I met who had a deep understanding of how social works. And it's social, both social the ugly viral and social the enabling social capital builder all rolled into one. So, you know, he had deep instincts about that. And, you know, he He kind of had the vision. He could communicate it. He could inspire.
We've established your credibility as a hardcore gamer, and now you play games like Farmville and Cityville. Let me ask on behalf of the remaining Zynga skeptics out there. Like, are these good games? Really? Are they really good games?
You know, I would say when I get to these games combine ClickZen. But you know, by the way, so does anybody ever play Diablo? You know, I was getting carpal tunnel playing Diablo.
What is ClickZen?
ClickZen. It's this higher state you get with constant clicking that some people also get with channel surfing with a TV remote. So we call it ClickZen. Good question. What is it? It's the Satori of game inputs. Satori reached by game inputs. So it's click zen, it's success with a feeling of challenge, kind of like playing golf on an easy golf course. But you know, if you break par on an easy golf course, hey, it's breaking par. I have my one hole in one on a chintzy ass par three, but you know, it's a hole in one.
So are they good games? Does that make them good games?
You know, Castleville is a pretty high work of art. And it's even Frontierville, Brian Reynolds, who did Alpha Centauri and Rise of Nations, thought it was his best work. And it's partly because, especially for PC game designers, it's more of a purity of design. And then we got to a point in games where the designers finished the game and then waited a year and a half for the artist to paint them. And so they started getting disconnected. And you know, kind of like talking to your friends through Dixie cups and a string. You know, they got removed. They couldn't iterate. So the game design feels purer. It's definitely a new form that you know we see people like Mark Skaggs. Each iteration gets new insights and building games on top of a kind of interrelated system games. On top of a server architecture is just really hard. And to do it in a way that wants to be flexible and where the economies don't break, it's really hard. It's kind of mind-bending. I also do crossword puzzles, and I do jigsaw puzzles. So my top 10 all-time favorite games include some casual games and include some core games. But I went back, I asked myself this kind of as I was getting involved with Zynga, what can I learn from my history? And I'm back and tried to think about what are my favorite game moments of all time. And I wrote a blog about it called From Moore's Law to Mother-in-Law, because I found out that all my favorite times in games, there was a picture of a person rather than a screenshot. You know, if you're a World of Warcraft fan, there's the Leroy Jenkins thing. But the fun about Leroy Jenkins is not the screenshot of Leroy. The fun is your pals who tell you about the story. And I started realizing that for me, my history in gaming is about the social relationships it creates. And it was, you know, my mother-in-law who stole the Sega Genesis from my brother who wanted to play Night Trap so she could play Columns. And then how we all sat around and laughed about that for the rest of a vacation. So the trying to build games that not only sit on servers with scale, but that connect you with friends, I actually think is a higher calling. And as I told you before, I'm now playing Scramble with friends. I'm pretty good at Scramble with friends. My 22-year-old and 20-year-old daughter are better at Scramble with friends. There's, you know, as a parent, you always think, wouldn't this be cool if your kids join you in whatever your hobbies are? And I knew in skiing that they were going to be better than me. I knew in biking they were going to be better than me. Just kind of the circle of life thing. I didn't really imagine that they were going to kick my ass in word games. And lo and behold, I can't keep up. I'm not sure they know what all the words mean, but they dust me, and it's with pride I eat crow at the end of every Scramble with Friends game. So they're trying to build these three vectors of games, which is build social capital with a broad number and reach masses and build a game, is a daunting challenge, and we're in the early days.
Last question about Zynga, and we'll move on. There's some talk among federal legislators in legalizing online gambling. If that happened tomorrow, and you're advising Mark and the rest of the Zynga team whether to go into that business, what do you say?
Let's see. I'd say in general, I'm favorable but nervous. What I'd say is the smartest people I've met about analytics and virtual goods actually come out of the casino business. I met a guy and he says, you know, all virtual goods businesses need to have two currencies. And I say, how did you know that? It took us years to figure that out. When you build a freemium game, you want to always have two currencies, and sometimes three. He says, well, it's obvious. You know, you want to have the money currency and you want to have the status currency. And so we give people rooms, we give them drinks, we give them, you know, better tables, and they earn that whether they win or lose. And he said, that's kind of the secret. The second currency is the secret. And so we already kind of talk the same language.
So what makes you nervous about it?
Oh, what makes me nervous about it is the murky history of cash-based gambling. I think it's too exciting not to try. I was never nervous about virtual goods, never nervous about the internet, never nervous about privacy. I do get nervous carrying a lot of cash around in my pocket.
So the topic of our talk here is gamify and socialize, and I think we've given short thrift to socialize up until now. Tell me, like, you administer the S Fund at Kleiner Perkins. Now, tell me, how much room do you think there is for entrepreneurs outside of really the two, what now appear to be the two dominant social platforms, Facebook and Twitter?
I've heard skeptics say social is over for basically since MySpace got the 70 million people and dusted Friendster. And, I think the innovator, that laws of nature in business are phase shifts in the innovator's dilemma. And I think there's no business model that has guaranteed legacy. You know, there's some meteor lurking out there to turn the T-Rexes into fossils. We just don't know when. There's such power. When I started in venture 3.5 years ago, the rule of thumb on Sand Hill Road, this road where Stanford owns, that it leases to all these venture capitalists because that's where the entrepreneurs used to be before they moved to San Francisco and Austin. But on Sand Hill, there was this belief that if any company that reached 500,000 monthly unique users had reached the tipping point and was now guaranteed success. And now we're only 3 years later, and 500,000 is like a joke. And 500,000, yeah, that's a good number if you're a commerce site and people are paying you $100 a basket. But the number now is 10 million. And in 3 years, the table stakes have increased by 20 times. And it's because of this magic of online viral. And, you know, I think a bunch of changes are happening. I think the Dunbar number is going to go from 150 to 500, that everyone's going to have 500 social connections instead of just presidents of countries. And we're seeing companies still skyrocket. And in areas where, you know, there seem to be no crevices, market crevices before, and we're seeing companies get to 10 million and 20 million and 50 million. I have news for you that a million used to be a big number. And a million anymore seems, you know, it's a big number if you try to get people in a hockey rink, but a million's no longer a big number on the internet. And so when you see leading indicators like that, that, you know, every year, every season, there's a new $10 or $50 million company, it's just hard to believe that we're doomed.
But it also seems like sometimes that, you know, it's last year's 50 million member startup that has fueled the growth of this year's, that people are sort of trying things out, moving on.
I'm in the disruption business. I think it's all coming out of the sleepy Fortune 500 companies.
What every South by Southwest feels like it has a bell of the ball startup, and this year it's the sort of passive location companies. I guess Highlight is one of them. What do you think of the idea there?
You know, a mobile social local thing called Badoo took Europe by storm about a year ago. You know, it's pretty compelling. The trick is to have it not become transactional. I believe that this whole local geo layer, so anybody who hasn't started a company yet, becoming kind of a visionary about local seems like a huge disruptor. It's going to be a disruptor for games. It's going to, you know, it's just this extra vector that the internet can bring to bear. Better than traditional meat life. But, you know, there was in Japan, there was a cell phone app at least 10 years ago. It was kind of like eHarmony that buzzed you whenever you were within 50 meters of someone that they thought you would get along with. And like some things Japanese, it didn't leave the island successfully. Never became Pokemon. You know, so I'm sure it's a great idea, and if the time's come, maybe the time has now come. But our, you know, back to that idea of 50 hours and 30 hours, we all need to become more efficient. And, you know, I think I've read that 25% of marriages, the relationships initiate online these days. Don't know if the marriages are better, but it sure saved time along the way. So we are in the time-saving mode. You know, for many of us who aren't just here to drink our brains out in the evening, even at something like South by Southwest is a time saver, you know, an accelerator. We're all in kind of the chess game of life, not to waste time and to do three things at once.
So we can't let you off the hot seat without asking you one or two Amazon questions. You're here preaching the twin values of gamification and social, and yet, you know, I can't think of maybe a lesser sort of social or gamified company than Amazon. Is Jeff Bezos not listening to you?
Nobody listens to me. The I think any Web 1 company that doesn't figure out the social web and the gamification techniques is at risk. But, you know, plenty of humans do at-risk things. And, you know, there's another approach, was if you're, you stick to your knitting, and if you get successful enough, you can always buy later. And, you know, so, you know, maybe Google will buy later, maybe Apple will buy later, maybe Facebook will buy later, maybe Zynga will buy later. It's kind of a tried and true approach. And even kings, if your country is going bad, go have your son marry someone from a country on the rise. So that's the other approach. Social's really hard. If you don't live it every day, and if you're not on Twitter and on Facebook and on Tumblr and on Path, you don't get it. Just like gamification is hard. If you haven't played some, you can't get it from the outside. By the way, branding is hard. I've found that if you describe how brands work to people who've never lived every day with brands that have created meaning for people, you can't understand it. It's very similar to me the way, as a parent,
I'm going to finally turn off the phone.
I think it's my daughter.
So let me take this opportunity to let you guys know that I'm going to, in 1 minute, open this up to questions. So you can begin lining up at the microphone right here on this side of the auditorium. And it's a very good opportunity, but probably don't pitch your company to Bing.
You asked me a question.
No, I'm telling them to ask you questions. But as you guys do line up, let me ask you one more Amazon question, which is, you've told me before.
Oh, I was going to say on parenting. This is important for any of you who aren't parents. What everybody tells you about parents won't make sense to you until you hold a child in your hands for the first time. It's indescribable. So, by the way, brands are the same way. And I think social is the same way as well. So, you know, don't invest in civilians of social who embark on social strategies.
Okay, we have our first question. Yes, sir.
I'm here to give away a free trip to Hawaii. That was a joke. That was part of the game.
I was suddenly looking forward to that.
More seriously, if we were to...
I have so many coconuts.
If we were to look at this present... And by the way, on behalf of everyone, thanks. We really appreciate the insight. If we were to redo this presentation with a layer of game mechanics on top of it, how would we do it differently?
Well, you'd get 5 points for Gryffindor if your question was better. No, just kidding. No, you get 5 points for Gryffindor for the question. The
I'd be dressed as a wizard.
It turns out that it's hard. I think I would have had clear rules about how to succeed here that Brad would have given me. We could have had a Twitter stream broadcast up here with competing for best questions and kind of like a dunk tank and putting me in a dunk tank. In general, as I said, I'm the video game business created by people who don't like this kind of presentation. So it may have been different. Maybe all of you playing musical chairs, and whoever asks a good question moves to the front, whoever asks a bad question moves to the back. But you do it peer reviewed, and you each ask each other questions in your row, and whoever you vote asks the best question moves forward. And then this front row would be an awesome, talented group, and we'd all go out to dinner. And the rest of you would try to meet all them on Highlight.
Yes, sir. Your question.
Hey, Bing. I just have a quick question for you. In which ways do you think that virtual goods can bridge the gap between our virtual lives and our real lives?
I'm kind of interested in the future of alternate reality gaming. You know, I think one day either our Yelp-like phone lens or else glasses are going to start giving us overlays that we value. I think we're going to head to a point in education, as we actually think about grades or virtual goods, that we're going to start finding secondary currencies in a lot of things we do with constant feedback. So I wish somebody would do kind of the World of Warcraft of personal fitness. I wish somebody would do the World of Warcraft of education. And it might be good to do it also in personal relationships. I think the world needs something other than like silver for the silver anniversary. And if you have a significant other who's a gamer, there might be other ways to get what you want besides, you know, pouting and strutting around in a towel.
Thank you. Yes, next question.
Hey, thanks again for your insight. Another quick question is, do you believe that the growing underlying desire to monetize engagement and social behavior in gaming now is affecting the quality of games in a negative or positive way? Do you think that it's more or less redefining what gaming should be for the future, or do you think that it's hurting what the traditional sense of gaming is?
Good question. I have some move up a row. I have mixed feelings about it. So I'm a believer in the profit motive. Again, I mentioned Diablo. I was a Diablo player. They had this thing called Battle.net, which ran servers. It crashed all the time. And the people who worked on it were deeply unhappy and had no honor in their organization. because they didn't bring in any money. So at Pogo, we actually turned on microtransactions so that the people involved got honor and made money. You know, they were profit center, not cost center. I think money is just one way that we tell people we like their work. And then in general, I wish that the world would go to this, that everything's free and pay later if you like it a lot. One of the things that seems to happen in social games is after people pay, they like the experience better. And there's some new rules here. Maybe it has to do with, you know, Kahneman and Freakonomics. But think of all the other walks of life where you pay first and find out later. So that being said, all incentive systems can be gamed, and you know, it makes me nervous when employees have gameable incentive systems. And I think the same thing for developers, that somehow or another you need to balance incentives. So in free games that where there's a way to pay money, what you really want to do is build a long-term emotional contract with users. And if paying money helps make that happen, that you can keep working and they like it better, that's a plus. If it becomes a grind and an irritation, that's a minus. So I think it's the money payment is part of the art, and the trick is to make it better rather than worse. You know, kind of like wearing clothes.
Thank you.
And by the way, you don't have to send compliments to start a question.
Thank you for absolving me of the need. Thank you for before my question. So I think my question is similar, or is kind of a riff on the previous one, which is, are there areas of activity that ought not to be incentivized through gamification? And one of the things that I'm thinking of is there was a study a while ago with some, I think it was kindergartners, they were given free time, and they noticed that the vast majority of them, they made paper and pens and crayons available, that they would just doodle and make drawings. And then, I'm sure I'll get the details of this wrong, but the general gist of it is they started rewarding them in various ways for as part of a controlled study to explicitly to make drawings and make art. And they found that when they then removed those rewards later, the kids were no longer as didn't find making art as appealing as they did.
That's a great one as well. So I think I'd summarize it by saying extrinsic rewards can be corrupting. I believe that of the grading system in schools, that many many teachers use it to corrupt the teaching process. My sense is that gaming to try to create behavior that wasn't naturally there is that it basically doesn't work. And extrinsic rewards don't work. Gaming to enhance behavior that's already there is just proven to work, but it creates meaning. So then there's a question in all games, what meaning do you want to create? So in a book called Home Game about hockey, Ken Dryden, the Hall of Fame goalie from the Montreal Canadiens and Cornell, he bemoans the fact that kids no longer get free play time, that it's structured, and so they don't do skill development. So even in games, there's the Will Wright approach who did The Sims, where he builds toys with open-ended, and Sid Meier does Civilization with the same kind of open-ended, but with a clear scoring. And Will Wright's games, we find that people who primarily play it as a game stop in 20 hours, and people who use the same game scoring but get more expansive, create stories, and try to compete to have their stories most read, play for hundreds of hours. So I think the I think you're pointing out a danger of extrinsic rewards, and it's kind of an illusion to think that extrinsic rewards could be used to turn basically spinach into banana splits. So it's kind of a helper. It's I think it's a free way to do something like a personal trainer. I don't know. I've used a personal trainer, not used a personal trainer, and with a personal trainer, I work out more often. So again, I would focus on extrinsic versus intrinsic. Cool.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I think we're going to do one more question. So no pressure.
I promise I'll try to make it good. So a few years ago, there was a game to promote Xbox that was involved bees somehow, but really it was this.
I love bees.
I love bees. Yes. Really interesting thing about it was that it was real life. It was a real life game that kind of tied together somehow and socialized.
That's kind of an augmented reality game.
The augmented reality.
And for people that haven't heard of it, it was there were clues buried in TV commercials and websites, kind of like mist level, really hard to figure out clues. And some people realized there might be something going on here. And a very small group started doing things like showing up at a lat longitude pay phone booth, remember them, to get a clue. And it was a PR stunt that people talked about the game more than played it. And the real world aspect of it is you had to walk around in geography to find stuff.
What's your question?
Well, I guess the question is
there will be more of those. They're really complicated to do, and there's a lot of friction. It turns out geography has a lot more friction in it than page rank and web pages.
And that's pretty much around my question is, how do you lessen that friction?
I think the most important way to lessen the friction is to put smartphones in everybody's pocket with highly accurate geo, both indoors and outdoors. So that, you know, your personal assistant knows where you are. And I think we're seeing an appetite for it. You know, Foursquare probably gets more attention than it gets usage. But I think this is gonna be universal. And there's a next generation of smartphones coming. Right now the GPS in smartphones is pretty inaccurate. And we're going to have smartphones in a couple of years that have sensors that once it takes a reading, it's going to be able to count your direction and your steps and plot you down to meters instead of blocks.
So hardware issues aside, is there a way to do that with game mechanics instead of depending on the industry?
Yeah, there's a company called Waze that it daily crawls a highway system. And it rewards people for being the first to drive a road. So basically, instead of an automated spider crawl, it's a car crawl. It's kind of like the SETI program for highways.
Thank you. Well, we're out of time, so let's thank Bing Gordon. Thank you.